Okay. So today's talk, for the sake of those posting it, we called Mahakashapa's Smile. And you might go Denkaroku : Mahakashapa's Smile. Because I'm going to probably end up doing a number of talks on the Denkaroku. And I will explain what the Denkaroku is in a moment. So not that long ago, I did a series of episodes on the Zen Studies podcast about spiritual inquiry, starting with episode 231. And I talked about the importance of questions for practice, obviously practical questions. If you just have a question about how to sit or, you know, who's Dogen or whatever, that's practical questions. But then later on, karmic questions. So studying the self, changing our behaviors, precept work. And then I said, there's also awakening questions. So awakening, and we're not even talking so much about questions like you could write it down in a sentence, but just a kind of a questioning mind, a sense of curiosity and edge and inquiry. So awakening questions, these are more existential. And then the fourth kind of question was skillful means questions, which is how do we manifest any understanding or insight we have? How do we manifest that skillfully in the world for the benefit of self and other, which is a kind of a whole nother kettle of fish. So that spiritual inquiry series of episodes, I was talking about spiritual questions. And by that, I was talking about the beyond practical ones. You might think of them as subjective questions. They're questions about what you can do or change or understand in your own body and mind. So, and also coming into awakening to reality with a capital R, I've been talking a lot about. So sometimes when I look over my Dharma talk topics, which because I give so many classes and do so many talks and I have a terrible memory, I keep these all on a spreadsheet. So it goes back many, many years and I have the topic, you know, so frequently I'll be like, I got a great idea. And then I'll do the search and I'll be like, oh yeah, I did that in January. Okay. I mean, it's good to kind of keep track of like, but sometimes I look down that list and I realize a lot of what I end up talking about is very practical. It's very applied. This has to do with karma. I mean, because it's such a huge part of our lives. And, you know, how do we just work with this in daily life and, you know, relationships and, you know, that's the kind of thing on Tuesdays right now. We're really, really talking about applied stuff. I think this Tuesday, I am going to be at the coast with my parents. So Mick is actually going to lead the discussion on your work as your gift to the world. So we're going to, last Tuesday we talked about, we're going to talk about betrayal, but that'll be the week after. So just if any of you are coming on Tuesday, it'll be about work. So that's very applied, but it's also valuable to spend some time, like I'm going to today, on, I don't know, you want to talk about the teachings that are a little more challenging, you know, teachings that point us toward, urge us toward awakening, toward a real radical shift in our sense of self and our perceptions about the world. So today, I think I did the first chapter in the Denkaroku of Shakyamuni's I and All Beings. So the Denkaroku, Denkaroku, and I can give you more info, is a book written by Keizan Zenji. So he was like four generations after Dogen. And it tells the story of like, here's Shakyamuni Buddha's awakening. And then here's the interaction he had with his first Dharma heir, Makakasho, and you know, his awakening, and then the next teacher and the next teacher, and it goes all the way down through the generations to just after Dogen. So generation after generation, these are the awakening stories of our Dharma ancestors. And they're really, really beautiful and poetic. And this is a very central text to our lineage and to Soto Zen. So as you know, many folks are aware of koan collections, and those are also used in Soto Zen, but we don't in Soto Zen use koans the way some Rinzai or Linji lineages use them, in a very kind of formal way, like I assign you a koan, you come in to meet with me, we have an interaction, and at some point I may or may not pass you on the koan, and you know, that's a vast oversimplification of how it all works, but we don't use them in that formal way generally. But still these stories are wonderful for pointing us beyond, right? Pointing us beyond just the ordinary way that we think and operate. So I'm going to mostly read this chapter and then just kind of stop and riff on it periodically. So I encourage you to just let the poetry and imagery and whatever just kind of wash over you. This is not the kind of thing where, you know, either I or anyone can just read this and be like, well, and this is what Kazan means, and this is what that image means. And, you know, it's not really like that. It's more evocative. And sometimes you may really think, you know, I'm new to this. I have no idea what these images mean, or what, I don't know, Buddha nature is, or whatever. And yet there's something that just, that kind of sounds, just feels right. It causes something to echo. And just in terms of, if you are curious about this book, so so this is the Transmission of Light. This is the translation by Thomas Cleary. There's one by Cook, and there's one put out by Shasta Abbey. Shasta Abbey, you can actually get it downloaded as a PDF from their website. From my perspective, Shasta's translation is very beautiful and inspiring, but more interpretive than other ones. Cleary is pretty straightforward, but if you're a total book nerd, so this is a translation put out by the Japanese Sotoshu and printed by the University of Hawaii Press. And so this is by T. Griffith Folk, F-O-U-L-K. You can actually get these as a PDF from the Sotoshu website. And so if anybody's curious, you can ask me, but just type Denkaroku into Google and a lot of this stuff comes up. But every page of it, it's like a book markup, and it has a little like, this is for personal use only, written across it. If you're like me, these two volumes are $85 from the University of Hawaii Press. So that's the Denkaroku. This is the glossary. So if you ever wonder what is the jade rabbit? You know, what is that? What is this? Look it up in here. Jade rabbit was a you know, poetic image for the moon. Oh, right. So it's, I don't know. I'm loving it. So I am going to read Folk's translation, which I feel it was kind of a consensus translation, lots of people involved in it. And I tend to really like, I mean, what do you mean by accurate, right? But I feel like it's minimally interpretive. So this is, it's the first chapter is on Shakyamuni, and now we're on to Venerable Mahakashyapa. So the first ancestor, Venerable Mahakashyapa, when the world honored one, the Buddha, held up a flower and blinked his eyes. Kashyapa cracked a slight smile. The world-honored one said, I have the treasury of the true Dharma eye, the sublime mind of Nirvana, which I entrust to Mahakashyapa. A little background on Mahakashyapa. Venerable Mahakashyapa's clan was Brahmana. The Sanskrit Kashyapa is translated here as most venerable swallower of light. When the venerable was born, a golden light filled the room, and all the light entered the venerable's mouth, for which reason he was named swallower of light. His body was golden hued, and he was fully equipped with the 30 of the 32 marks of a Buddha. It's all these, like, according to the mythology, right? There's some, if your earlobe is long and your, like, your fingers are slightly webbed, and like all these, there's these physical marks of a Buddha. In front of the stupa of many suns, the Mahakashyapa encountered the world honored one for the first time. When the world honored one said, "Welcome, Bhikshu," the Mahakashyapa's beard and hair instantly fell out. A kesa, monk's robe, draped itself on his body. Thereupon, Buddha entrusted him with the treasury of the true Dharma eye, and he practiced the 12 austerities, never wasting any time through the 12 periods of the day. Seeing only the shabby appearance of his worn-out robes, all in the following were suspicious of him. In response to that, whenever Shakyamuni, the honored one, preached the Dharma at assemblies here and there, he shared his seat and had Kashyapa sit next to him. Thereafter, Kashyapa was the senior seat at assemblies. And he was not only the senior seat in Shakyamuni Buddha's following, but the senior seat who had never retired in the followings of the Buddhas of the past as well. We know from this that he was an old Buddha. Do not rank him among those who were merely ordinary disciples of Buddha. That was the situation when at an assembly on Vulture Peak, before a gathering of 80,000, the world-honored one held up a flower and blinked his eyes. No one knew his intention, and they were silent. At the time, Mahakashyapa alone cracked a slight smile. The world-honored one said, I have the treasury of the true Dharma eye, the sublime mind of Nirvana, which is the fully clear and signless Dharma gate. I entrust it entirely to great Kashyapa. So we see this as our first Dharma transmission. This is the first time in Zen. I mean, according to the Pali Canon, there were other people that Shakyamuni acknowledged before this, but in our telling, Kashyapa was the first ancestor. So this is the first time that the Buddha said publicly to everyone else, this person understands what I understand. They can carry this Dharma the same way I carry it. So the imagery of this guy, and there's, you know, subsequent ancestors are not like this at all. Like, actually the third ancestor, Ananda, practices for like 40 years before he gets it. So just in case you're wondering if all the ancestors are like this, this is Mahakashyapa is like just a natural, you know? I mean, as soon as he met the Buddha just said, hi, monk. And then his hair fell out and he had a monk's robe on, and, you know, he got it right away. So that's that image. It's like, okay, we've had this remarkable disciple of the Buddha. So that's the basic story. And then here's the investigation. The story of the holding up of a flower at that time has been individually transmitted from ancestor to ancestor. It has not been made known recklessly to outsiders. Therefore, it is not something that sutra masters and treatise masters or many Zen masters are likely to know. Truly, I have come to understand that they do not know the truth of this matter. So he's saying there's something subtle going on here. And now it gets borrowed. Although it reads like this, such a koan, to pause, koan being a story like this, a story about an interaction between a teacher and a student generally, that is just, it's very intriguing. It's a point of questioning for us. What is going on here? And oftentimes it results in the student, you know, waking up, not always, but it's something for us. It's a worthwhile story, which then gets passed down through the generations that we're meant to explore, because it may be edifying for us. So such a koan as this story is not a koan from an assembly on Vulture Peak. It is a saying from a time when the Dharma was entrusted in front of the stupa of many suns. So this was, it's said the Dharma was, that he's saying all of this happened as soon as Shakyamuni and Mahakashapa met. So it's like the essence of the matter is not about the Buddha was on Vulture Peak and this smile and this interaction. It's like what really mattered happened in front of the stupa of many suns. What is recorded in works such as the record of the transmission of the flame and record of the pervasive spread of the flame, so these are other books like the Tenkaroku with these stories, which is that these words were spoken at an assembly on Vulture Peak, is mistaken. When the Buddha Dharma was first entrusted, there was this sort of formality. Thus, if one is not an ancestral teacher who transmits the seal of Buddha mind, one does not know the timing of that held up a flower and does not understand held up a flower. Zen worthies, you should meticulously inquire until you arrive at understanding, are able to see in detail, know what is Kashyapa about Kashyapa. Understand what is Shakya, Shakyamuni, about Shakya. And individually transmit this profound and completely sublime way. Setting aside for the moment, held up a flower, each person should come to clarify the place where he blinked his eye. When all of you routinely raise your eyebrows and blink your eyes, there's not a hair's breadth separation between that and Gotama's held up a flower and blinked his eyes. When all of you smile slightly when talking, there is not even a single hair's breadth of difference between that and Mahakashapa's cracked a slight smile. Nevertheless, if you are not clear about who is it that raises the eyebrows and blinks the eyes, then Shakyamuni and Kashyapa will be in Western lands. They will be far away from here. They will be far in the past. And skin, flesh, bones, and marrow will be in your own body. So skin, flesh, bones, and marrow is a Bodhidharma. When he transmitted to his disciples, he said, I transmit to you the skin, and you the flesh, and you the bones, and you the marrow. You know, and he was talking about the essence of the Dharma. And here it's saying, we'll just think that these words are just like, oh, they're just talking about skin and flesh and bones and marrow. With so many eye flowers and so much floating dust, you have yet to be liberated for innumerable kalpas past, and you will surely be drowning for kalpas to come. So eye flowers are like, if you have a disease of the eye, you think you see things that aren't really there. And obviously, floating dust is another thing that we can, it's a symbol of these kind of, we mistake things for real and are not. So what is going on here? when all of you routinely raise your eyebrows and blink your eyes. There's no difference. So I don't know how much of an aspiration you have or how separate you feel from it sometimes. But I imagine all of us can think of Shakyamuni, we can think of a teacher, we can think of the Dalai Lama, we can think of someone who is wise, who has this, whatever, this understanding, this liberation, this, they have something that we want to understand, we want to see for ourselves. And so we see them do an action or say something, and it seems to point to something we don't have. But it's saying there is nothing that this person has that you don't have. So I asked Dennis to go get a flower. So when Shakyamuni held up a flower, we want to think, you know, if I'm going to hold up a flower for Shoketsu, that means like, I've got a secret message and this is a symbol for like, remember that thing, you know? And then you go like, yeah, you know, like this is a symbol. This is just a stand in for something. But it's not. Like, here it is. Here it is. I mean, it could just as readily be, here it is. And I think when we are presented with a Dharma challenge, it doesn't have to be explicit, but when we're presented with a Dharma challenge, and we look for that sense of faith and centeredness, we go looking for it. What do I understand? What do I know? What can I count on? Who am I? What have I figured out? And for me anyway, I don't know, but I almost feel myself like go backwards into my head. You know, you ask me this question. All right, and it's, here it is. And then he's like, let's see. You know, I don't know. You know, I heard Dogen meant this once, you know, I don't know. We go look, we go somewhere else to look. And I feel like, you know, the real answer to this is just, it's not looking anywhere else. It's just unshakable, right here, which is not easy to do. And I feel like we're all developing more of a relationship with this authenticity, with whatever this is, which is hard to put your finger on, right? I have been working on it for over 25 years now. And in certain settings, right here, I can feel pretty centered and clear. But then if I go and like I interact with Hogen out at the monastery, you know, my Dharma senior by 30 years, you know, he can say something to me which makes me go, you know, knocks me off my center. So it's like, it's not an all or nothing thing, right? That you suddenly arrive at this calm and 100% of the time you're just enlightened, right? It's a growing confidence in our that our direct experience is it. It's right here. So it's not in the past. It's not about other people who are enlightened or somebody who was enlightened in the past, some enlightened moment some secret message that's passing between Shakyamuni and Mahakashapa. It was that they had this moment of like, then those eye flowers and the floating dust, right? It's all that other stuff that we chase after and we think we're going to find the answer there. If you once become conscious of that Lord Master, then truly Mahakashapa will be in all of your shoes, able to move your toes. Don't you know that in the place where Gotama raised his eyebrows and blinked his eyes, Gotama is utterly extinguished and done with? And that in the place where Kashyapa cracked a slight smile, Kashyapa comes to have an attainment of awakening. Is this not precisely what is meant by I have? When the Shakyamuni says, I have the treasury of the true Dharma. The treasury of the true Dharma I, on the contrary, was entrusted to one's own self, and that was all there was to it. Thus, you should not proclaim that it involved Kashyapa, and not proclaim that it involved Shakyamuni. There is no giving of a single Dharma to another, and no receiving of a single Dharma from anyone. This is what we proclaim as the true Dharma. In order to demonstrate this, one held up a flower and made known that which is unchanging. The other cracked a slight smile and made known his seniority. In this way, master and disciple have a face-to-face encounter and the vital bloodline flows uninterrupted. So if you become conscious of that Lord Master, this is kind of a weird term. And if you read the Shasta Abbey version, I mean, Roshi Kennett came from the Anglican Church. And so she really put a lot of like theistic imagery into her translations. So you're going to read like, I think she calls it the Lord of the House. And then she puts it all in like capital letters. So every time you get to this, it's like, and the Lord of the House. But if you become conscious of what this is referring to, not that this is a simple thing to grasp, but the Lord Master is not, it's not Shakyamuni, it's not anything out there. The Lord Master is the master of our house. It's like the one who raises the eyebrows and blinks the eye and wiggles the toes. It's the one who, you know, I asked people during session when we were eating, just like, you know, watch your hands. Who is doing this? Your hands are just, you know, they're, you know, doing this. You're not even the conscious part that we identify with is not doing this. I mean, it can kind of interfere if we think about it. But there's the vast majority of the time, it really has nothing to do with that little conscious piece of ourselves. And we have a sense of this. We have a sense that there's an authentic person in here. And a lot of times that authentic person is not really like, I'm kind of, you know, suppressing or obliterating that authentic person, right? The authentic person doesn't perhaps often come out and speak and be seen. That we're, you know, we got a lot of masks, or we got a lot of ways that we cope and deal with the world, and it doesn't necessarily feel authentic. And this is a really interesting point of tension, because many people think of Buddhism and Zen and that, like, I'm going to learn that I have no self, right? And I'm going to learn to see past and let go of all these details, right? We say, like, that's just a story about yourself. You know, your body, your feelings, the stories you tell, your past, all of that is empty. No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, right? We're kind of deconstructing the self. And yet that's not the whole story. We're trying to let go of our attachments to the particulars, which we usually identify as self. I am my thoughts, or I am my opinions, or I am my feelings, or I am my body. We're kind of let go of that. And yet, then we talk about, you should become conscious of the Lord Master. Conscious of this. And another way that we talk about this is our Buddha nature. There is, and it's very frustrating because it's not a thing, right? It's not a, oh, now I, there it is. I've found the one who moves my hands, right? Like, there's a part of us that does that, right? I'm going to find the true self. It tells me I have a true self, so I'm going to go find it. And yet, although we cannot find it, although we cannot grasp it, it is 100% here. What else? Who else could be here? Once you become conscious of that Lord Master, then truly Mahakashapa will be in all of your shoes, able to move your toes. So this monk who was just like, you know, Mr. Cool, who just from the very beginning was just, you know, an instant monk, practiced in many lifetimes, immediately got it. He can wiggle your toes. Like that being can be right there. I mean, so intimate with you that it's like, there's no difference. You wiggle your toes, Mahakashapa wiggles his toes. Fully clear, complete knowing does not involve thought. Having utterly cut off the faculty of mind, as was fitting, Mahakashapa entered Cocksfoot Mountain to await the far-off birth of Maitreya. So that's the Buddha to come. Let's see. I'll just continue. None of it should be skipped. Therefore, even now, Mahakashapa has not entered extinction. If you intimately study the way and thoroughly investigate it in detail, then it is not only is Kashapa not extinguished, but Shakyamuni Buddha too abides eternally. Thus it is that since long before any of you people were born, they directly pointed to and individually transmitted the true Dharma. From the past right to the present, they have been striking resounding blows. Therefore, you people should not yearn for some bygone age, 2,000 years past. If you just pursue the way urgently, gently, urgently today, then Kashapa will not enter Cocksfoot Mountain, but truly will appear in the world right now. Thus it is that Shakyamuni Buddha's blood relations will be warm even now. And Kashapa's slight smile will also be fresh. If you are able to arrive at such a standpoint that it is you, on the contrary, who will be the heirs of Kashapa, and Kashapa, on the contrary, will receive the Dharma from you. Not only will the lineage extend from the seven Buddhas to you, but truly you will become the ancestral teachers of the seven Buddhas. It is merely people's vigor or lack of vigor that determines whether the Buddhas appear or disappear. Even in the present day, if one continuously pursues the way and thoroughly understands it in detail, then Shakyamuni will immediately appear in the world. It is only because all of you remain unclear about your own self that Shakyamuni long ago entered extinction. You are already children of Buddha. How could it be suitable for you to kill the Buddha? Because if you don't understand yourself, then Shakyamuni Buddha doesn't exist anymore. So you're killing the Buddha because he only manifests when you understand yourself. This is why you must immediately pursue the way and quickly meet your compassionate father. As a matter of course, that old guy Shakya walks, sits, stands, and reclines along with all of you, engages in conversation and socializing along with all of you, and is never apart from you at any time. If any of you go through your entire lives without seeing that old guy, then no matter who you are, you will be a person who is utterly unfilial. You are already called children of Buddha. If you are unfilial, then even the hands of 1,000 Buddhas cannot reach you. So I was thinking about how this is, it's kind of like the Zen version of grace. You know, the message that we are already saved, we are already in the bosom of the divine, and yet you have to open up and receive that. You know, it's somehow this entails our participation. This is just a great mystery and something that we wrestle with, right? Yeah, we can hear, well, that's okay, whatever, we're children of the Buddha. We have this great, you know, Buddha nature. And I guess, you know, we can take some solace in that, I guess it can be, but it really doesn't help all that much, right? Like, okay, but why don't I feel like that? Or why is life like this anyway? So there's a way we have to open up to it. But I think this is just such a beautiful chapter for pointing toward, you know, it's not what we think. It's not about coming to understand something profound out there. You know, it's not about becoming different so that we're this kind of person. It's about absolutely and utterly just coming home and realizing this is it. And, but not this is it in a minimizing way, right? Not this is it as in like, well, you know, I guess this is it. Nothing's ever really going to change. But this is it in like a very full way, right? Realizing, oh, really am. I'm no different than the ancestors. Really get it. So, all right, we have a few minutes left. We got a good 15 minutes left or so. So, questions and comments, unless that just kind of blew your mind. James.
Thank you. Sorry, I jumped together. I was, it put me in mind, this is going to be a scattered thought and not maybe not even a question, but when you were saying that about you're holding up the flower, you may as well have been holding up the quesu beater, you know, and it put me in mind of two other koans that I believe are in the Gateless Barrier. I can't remember exactly the stories, the Zen masters involved, but the one was, you know, they were the same general teaching as this one, and the same general, like, it was a little more of a direct interaction where a monk came to the Zen master and said, what is Buddha nature? What is the meaning of Bodhidharma? Whatever, you know, gave that question. And the teacher responded, one teacher, I think it was Guishan, I can't remember, responded 3 pounds of flax. And then the other teacher, in a different setting, responded, what is the meaning of Buddha nature? Responded with dried shit stick, you know, and that it was, yeah. And, it, you know, like this, and I actually appreciated that because it seemed to me like the story of the holding up the flower, like the imagery is so beautiful. And it, like, you can almost read too much into it and start going, well, what does the flower mean? Is it because the flower comes from the earth and we're all of the earth? Like, and you can start to just spin the story out. Mm-hmm. But when somebody comes to you and say, what is the meaning of, you know, what is Buddha nature? Dried shit sticks. Like, what in the what? Like, when I first read that, I was like, that's like, it seemed almost offensive. But then you realize, like, he was, the Zen master had just come out of the latrine and was literally holding the little stick that the monks would use to wipe themselves, and it dried it off. And that's what he had in his hand. And like, he was basically saying, just this is it. Like, this, whatever is your immediate experience is all of it, is the Buddha nature. And so I love that, the juxtaposition of this really beautiful, happy image and this kind of nasty image. And like, they're both kind of the same. They both mean the same thing ultimately. So that was, it just put me in mind of that. So thank you.
And I want to point out that, we can't be afraid of making mistakes. I mean, we, this whole process, if we're afraid of making mistakes, we're probably not going to make much progress. So we're going to go off on either side, which is like, somebody, you know, if we were doing Dharma combat, I'd be like, you know, Brian, show me an authentic moment, you know. And if you go like, you know, if you hesitate and you think, oh shit, I don't know, like, is this authentic? I don't know. Like, if you hesitate, obviously, you know, you're not able to do it. But on the other hand, if you go, all right, here I am, like, what are you relying on? What is that responding, right? And there's a way that is, as long as it's about, if I'm going to do that, and I'm doing that because in my mind I'm thinking, I'm a Zen teacher and I've practiced for 25 years, so I know, like, that really isn't it, right? And any teacher who is more experienced than I am is going to see that, right? They're going to be like, really? You know, I might impress you guys. I'm like, you know, but you know, somebody more experienced is gonna be like, well, and then I'll go, you know. So it's not about kind of building up the skill or the know-how or the insights or the anything. It's really, it's a very simple and humble and vulnerable space in a way that has nothing to prove. I saw a hand over here. All right, well, Ginger, go ahead.
Excuse me. I appreciated Jane's question, and it reminded me of what I just read in Thich Nhat Hanh's book, The Miracle of Mindfulness. And he's talking about, you know, I'm sitting here listening to you in this wonderful talk. And this right here is the most important thing in the world to me. And when I get up and go to the bathroom, getting up and going to the bathroom will be the most important thing in the world to me. I find, just the way he expressed it, he expresses things so beautifully. I found it very touching. Mm-hmm. And the preciousness of every moment and how I aspire to be awake for as many moments as I possibly can. Otherwise, I'm wasting my days and nights in vain. Otherwise, I'm not living. So that's what all of this reminded me of, and I really appreciate it. I did always wonder about the flower, I gotta admit.
And there's another aspect to this whole chapter, I think, that it's a very kind of sweet, loving, compassionate chapter in a way. Like, like, you know, if you just realize who you are, Makakash Shapa's gonna, you know, wiggle your toes. And he says, old guy Shakyamuni is always around. And like when we smile, when we're just having a conversation, that's the same thing. It's like, I think everybody I know, including myself, of course, at some level thinks I don't have it. I don't belong. I'm not qualified. And like, it's like there's this deep longing to just know. Like it sounds kind of lame to just say like we are okay, but that, I don't know, that we are, I mean, it sounds a little bit, you know, the Buddha's our compassionate father. It sounds a little bit like, I don't know if I really want to be like children around the feet of the Buddha or something. And yet, if we think in terms of really positive terms, father or mother, of being, I like to imagine, you know, like this being that I completely trust, has my best interests in mind, and is wise, and is not just pulling one over on me. You know, and they embrace me and they say, worry about it. It's totally okay. It's totally okay. You know, and like that, just imagining being embraced by that. I think that's what's inviting us to try for. Veronica.
It's a great, great talk. I hadn't heard that story before. And this past week, I've been thinking a lot about, Leah did the talk about art and art and Zen. And I am an artist. And so this week I finally got up the nerve and I sent out a few art email to the Sangha and got some nice replies. And it's funny because when you started the talk and you said, oh, it's about a flower, I was like, aha, Domio's going to teach me how to incorporate the lotus into my art. And I was like, great, it's going to get even more zenny. And then in listening to you talk, I kind of realized that's not the way it works. I don't even need to worry about that, because if I just be zen-like and practice zen, then that's just going to come out in my art automatically anyway. And I don't need to worry about it so literally. So anyway, that's just coming at it from a different angle. But it was a good follow-up from Leah's talk where, I don't know, connections. So.
Wait. Thank you. So hopefully this, I don't know, I'm trying to picture folks going across the street to lunch and I don't know, some just be like, I don't know, nothing to talk about from today's talk, or whether it actually be like, what is with that? I don't know. But I do think it's, you know, I think for me, it's a delight to give this kind of talk, because in some ways, like other kinds of talks, I'm like, all right, well, how do I explain this thing? You know, and I can do it pretty easily. This is not so easy, right? I mean, I don't know. Like, I've actually talked about this with, I was just for a. And only one day, but I went to a Zen teachers conference that's nearby. And we were talking about this with some other Zen teachers, about like balancing the teachings about the absolute and relative. And we're like, yeah, I mean, what do you say? What, I don't, you know, it kind of defies description. It defies words. And yet, so when I go to prepare for this, it's like it's challenging for me. It's the, you know, it's the edge of my practice as well. Like, what is this? And it reminds me of, to some extent, I feel like it reminds me of what this is all about. You know, this is not Zen, it's not a glorified self-improvement project. With that, that's some work that we do as well. We work on ourselves, but this is what, you know, this is what gives it the juice. This is what really inspires, hopefully. All right. abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.
All right, thank you for coming, everyone.